Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week, a new ferry running to France and Spain from Rosslare Ferryport. The 160th anniversary of the loss of the Taylor is marked next week in Rush. Jarlath Cunnan and Northabout are honoured by the Ocean Cruising Club in London. Hugh Oram takes us on the Summit Canal between Newry and Lochnay. We have the second part of our conversation with water rescue dog handler Mick McCarthy and music from the late Liam Clancy. First this week to a note from a Seascapes listener, Anthony O'Connor in Malahide, who writes, January the 17th each year reminds me of the global event 62 years ago when Captain Kurt Carlson remained alone aboard his sinking ship, the Flying Enterprise, in the Atlantic Ocean for 13 days. In January 1952, in a valiant attempt to save his doomed ship, which eventually sank, but the captain was saved. As a young chap of 8 years, I was glued to the wireless each day as Radio Éireann reported on the fate of the captain and his ship, and it was gripping material that held us all spellbound. No TV in those days, just raw radio that left everything to the imagination. It was a global, epic news story at the time which captured the world's attention to see if the captain could succeed to save his ship. Alas, it was not to be. Have you any archival material that you could broadcast by way of memorial and to enable people of a particular vintage to relive those epic moments again? Enjoy the show, not on Friday nights, but in the early hours of Monday morning for the repost. Kind regards, Anthony O'Connor, Malahide, County Dublin.
Radio Éireann.
Well, Anthony, to coincide with that anniversary, here from the RTÉ Radio Archives is an extract from that broadcast you recall hearing as a youngster.
Diary of 1952. Tonight people are celebrating with music and laughter. They are sitting on soft chairs in front of warm fires.
But my first story of the year is about a man who sat on an upturned box in a half-capsized ship at sea and warmed his hands at the flame of a candle. The man was Captain Kurt Carlson of the Flying Enterprise. You remember the basic facts of this. The Enterprise, an American freighter, damaged by heavy seas 300 miles southwest of the Irish coast 3 days after Christmas 1951. Passengers and crew were landed at Rotterdam, but Carlson, to save his company heavy salvage claims, refused to abandon ship.
For 6 days, the freighter wallowed on her side, drifting helplessly. And for 6 days, world interest centered on the battle between Kurt Carlson and the Atlantic Ocean. Then on the 3rd of January, the British turmoil got a tow line on the Enterprise, as observers on the USS Willard Keith told us.
I think the success in getting the tow wire aboard was eventually due to some comparatively calm weather and the fact that the chief mate of the Dancy, chief mate of the turmoil, by the name of Dancy, managed to get aboard the Enterprise while she was working under the stern of the Enterprise.
5 days later in the newsroom, we had this report by Carlson himself from the Enterprise.
Fine and dandy. We got some warm clothes from my slop chest, some clean underwear, dungarees, even a pair of new shoes, and clean socks. It's all set. It's feeling very good. Over.
But however cheerful they may have sounded, Carlson and Dancy were having a cold and desperate time of it. Their hopes and possibly their very lives depended on that all-important tow line.
Captain Carlson inspected 2 days ago. There was a little chafing or a possibility of it, so he looked around for some grease, and until we could pass it over to him on the high line, he found a pound of butter and put that on it to hold it, have it heavily greased temporarily. That was a stopgap measure until we could get some heavy grease over to him. Over.
On January the 9th, the tow line parted. The Enterprise settled over farther on her side. The end was near, but still Carlson refused to leave.
This is the Willard, Keith. The Flying Enterprise is still afloat. She's at about 80 degrees right now. Captain Carlson and Mr. Dancy are standing on the starboard side of the deckhouse. Over.
That was on the last day, January the 10th. The weather was growing worse. Huge waves were rolling right over the ship. As darkness came on that evening, the world knew that if Carlson and Dancy risked another night on board, it might be their last. At 4 p.m., in the gathering dusk, came this news.
Land's End, this is the Willard, Keith. Flying Enterprise is now on her side, about 90% underwater, with waves breaking over. She's still partly afloat, over.
And finally, the brief message over the radio telephone that wrote the end to a gallant story.
In case you haven't received the report, the Flying Enterprise has gone under. Over.
Taken from the RTE radio archives, as requested by Seascape's listener, Anthony O'Connor, in Malahide. In the same year that the Isolde was launched by Irish Shipping. Shame to see that with the recent exposure of the vessel the Sunbeam on Ross Bay Strand, there are now plans to rebury the wreck because of people interfering with the timbers. Hard to credit that some people have such a lack of respect for the environment. LD Line's new passenger and freight ferry service between Rosslare Europort in Ireland to the west coast of France and the port of Saint-Nazaire and the northern Spanish port of Gijon was successfully launched during the first week of January. The first ever ferry link between Ireland, western France and northern Spain will open up opportunities and forge new trading links, combined with cost-saving advantages and environmental benefits for tourist passengers and hauliers, so say LD Lines. For the tourist and freight markets bypassing the UK land bridge, the link to Gijon makes destinations in Spain and Portugal easier than ever to drive to and generally provides quicker access to and from the continental mainland. Leading French ferry and holiday company Brittany Ferries this week announced that an order has been placed for a new cruise ferry that will be its largest yet and one of the biggest such vessels in the world. It will also be the cleanest, most environmentally friendly ship to operate in Irish UK waters, as liquefied natural gas emits about 25% less carbon dioxide during combustion than marine fuel oil and burns with no smoke. It is entirely free of sulphur and is very low in nitrogen oxide emissions. You can see and read more on the Seascapes webpage, www.rte.ie/radio1/seascapes. The new ship will replace Brittany Ferries' current flagship Pont-Aven, which will move to the Portsmouth-Saint-Malo route in 2017. Much devastation has been caused to our remarkable coastline. Next week, we'll be hearing how the storms have also uncovered medieval burial sites, sunken dwellings, and parts of a Neolithic bog. We'll be talking to archaeologist Michael Gibbons here on Seascapes next Friday night. To Newry next, and we hear from writer and broadcaster Hugh Oram about the remarkable Summit Canal.
The Newry Canal, connecting that city with Loch Ness, dates back to the middle of the 18th century and set an enviable first. It was the first summit canal built in either Ireland or Britain, and it turned out that the canal technology used here in Ireland gave Irish canal builders a 30-year head start over their opposite numbers in Britain. Mind you, the canal had been a long time coming. During the dark days of the Cromwellian invasion of Ireland in the mid-17th century, 100 years previously, a certain Colonel Monk had the route surveyed and decided it would be an excellent idea to dig a canal, but nothing happened. Nearly 50 years later, in 1703, the canal route was again surveyed and a draft bill was prepared for the Irish House of Commons, but this too proved a damn squib. For the second time, nothing happened. It was definitely a case of third time lucky, all due to the coal merchants of Dublin. They decided it would be much more sensible to bring coal from the coal fields around Coal Island in County Tyrone direct to Dublin and stop buying the much more expensive cross-channel coal. So in 1729, an Act of Parliament was passed in Dublin to enable the construction work to start. Work on the canal from Newry began in 1734 under Richard Cassels, a renowned architect and engineer. He managed, however, to fall foul of his bosses on the project and 2 years later was dismissed. And as it happened, it proved no setback at all, as he went on to design many big houses in Ireland, including Leinster House, home of the Doyle and Shannon. The work on the canal was handed over to an engineer called Thomas Dears. Despite lots of engineering difficulties and an absolute profusion of legal disputes with landowners along the way, the canal was finally completed and declared open in a lavish ceremony on March the 28th, 1742. And in parallel with the canal, another one was built, linking Albert Basin in Newry with Victoria Lock, where it enters Carlingford Lock. It's hard to imagine now, but once, so many years ago, Newry was the fourth busiest port in Ireland. The completed canal from Newry to Lough Neagh was impressive, all of 28 kilometres long, with 14 locks and a depth of up to 2 metres. The first two boats to use the canal were called the Bolter and the Cope, and they carried Coal Island coal en route to the hearths of Dublin. In due course, the Newry Canal found competitions from the railways more and more severe. Ironically, the railway line from Newry to Portadown runs alongside the canal for much of its length, and if you take the Enterprise Express between Dublin and Belfast, you'll see much of the old canal. It's still in a good state of preservation, and the locks are all open, so there's a free flow of water, even though the lower sections of the canal are clogged with weeds. And the last vessel to sail its length in 1937 was a pleasure yacht. The canal itself was abandoned in 1949. The stretch through Newry lasted longer until 1956, serving warehouses there. In 1958, a fixed bridge was built in Newry, and this severed the link between the canal and the ship canal. But the ship canal itself continued to trade until 1974, when the port of Warren Point took over the trade. And March of that year saw the last ship enter the locks. However, the ship canal is still used by pleasure craft. As for the Newry to Lough Neagh canal, it nearly disappeared altogether. In the early 1960s, there were plans to build a motorway along the bed of the canal, but fortunately these never came to pass. And these days, much of the canal's physical appearance, including the towpaths and canal-side buildings, has been preserved by a legion of dedicated enthusiasts. But as to whether the canal can ever be returned to use as a working canal, at least for pleasure craft, is a question that remains to be decided.
Hugh Oram on the Newry to Lough Neagh Canal. Irish sailor Jarlath Conan has been awarded the prestigious Vassie Vase Trophy by the Ocean Cruising Club at its awards ceremony in London this week. The top prize in world cruising achievements is for the Mayo Man's unusual and exploratory voyage through the White Sea Canal, through Russia and around Scandinavia. Jarlath and crew aboard his sailing vessel Northabout set out from Westport in Ireland for a journey to St. Petersburg and through the Belomorsk Canal into the White Sea. In fact, when they were on the voyage, they sent us a postcard from the Belomorsk Canal. north about, logged over 4,500 miles in this adventure. She passed through 6 canals and river systems en route, including 115 locks. Each year, the Ocean Cruising Club recognises the achievements of ordinary individuals doing extraordinary things on the world's oceans and brings those achievements to the attention of the sailing community at large.
When I've done my work of day and I roll my boat away down the waters of Loch Tay as the evening light is fading and I gaze upon Ben Lyons where the afterglow unto bright eyes and the melting mouth below. She's my beauteous evening, my joy and sorrow too. And if she prove untrue, well, I cannot live without her, for my heart support in tone, and I give the world to know why she means to let me go as I sing I weep.
The Loch Tay Boat Song, performed by the late Liam Clancy and taken from the album Songs for the Rivermen. Next here on Seascapes, to the second part of our conversation with Mick McCarthy on the training and working with water rescue dogs.
Contrary to popular opinion, water actually holds scent better than land. Scent is like smoke. When there's a body in the water, the scent leaves that body for as long as there's marrow in those bones that'll be there. It could be years afterwards in some cases. But as long as there's something there, that dog will find it. I mean, many people have pet dogs who've dug bones up that have been buried for years. How did they know it was there? They use their nose. So the scent will follow the current and exit the water at a given point. And when it exits the water, it spreads in what we call a scent cone. Not in a triangle as we imagine a cone to be, because we really don't know. We've used smoke bombs and flares to try and match it, but we're never sure. But a lot has to do then with when the dog enters the scent cone, he's taught to bark. Most dogs, when it's dead, unfortunately, they become distressed as opposed to barking. Live body, they'll start barking, but they whine a lot. And when they leave the scent cone, so you zigzag up a river, say Cock Harbour, and when they hit the scent cone, if they do, they'll become either distressed or bark. And when they leave the scent cone on the other side, they'll actually stop. So you gradually narrow it down. You have somebody, a navigator on the boat, making a mark on a map to the point where, okay, now we've gone past where the dog is not indicating on anything. So we circle around again.
So you almost follow a grey dog.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And we find the exit point. So we, as the Navy said to us, at least we can confirm if there's a body there or not in the water. That means they can put their divers down where the dog is indicating strongest, which we would believe to be the exit point for the scent. And there may be more than one exit point, but depending on the conditions. They can spread their divers out from there and hopefully locate the body then. Because dogs will not pinpoint a body in the water, depending on the depth, of course. But they will tell you if there is a body in the water. When we are called, we get called by the guards, but we regularly get called by civilians, family members and that. And fortunately, we don't answer civilian calls. We have to okay it with the local guard station. So we either contact that local Garda station, or we ask the family member who rings us to contact the Garda to contact us and say it's okay to go in. Unfortunately, again, that takes days again to get a reaction. In many cases, we're told, oh, there's no need for you, you're okay. To be called in 2 weeks later, oh, lads, can you come up now? And we say, you were aware of us 2 weeks ago. We feel like saying no, but of course we don't. It's not the time or place to be arguing points. But we go when we're called. But in many cases when we go, we know definitely in 75% of cases we're going on a waste of time because we're not going to find anything. It's too late. We're being called in much too late. And not just us, SARDA and other dog handlers are the same. We are all in the same boat, that dogs get called too late. They should be called first. Searchers should be left at home for 24 hours, leave the dogs out, see if they can find anything. If not, no harm done, no bring in the volunteers. If somebody turns up at a search, and if they have a walking pole, a pair of boots, and a backpack, they're in. That's it. Nobody questions, do you have an ailment that may affect you, that you might drop dead of a heart attack or something? But no, nobody questions anybody. If they turn up, they're used. That's it. Sent out, and they wouldn't have a clue. Like, the majority of civilians should not be involved in searches because it actually creates major problems in a search for a missing person. Now, they're all well-meaning, but there are enough people, search teams, who are trained to cover it. But a lot of search teams, if we go in and say there are certain teams turn up, we just go home because we know we're wasting our time.
What water search really stands out for you in stuff that you've done to date?
Probably the one off Dunmore East, but more than there has been one which I wasn't involved in, which I heard about recently from a friend of mine who in the north, where he was called out by a family. And the police came along with their dogs and told them to step aside. They ran their boat and dog over an area and said, there's nobody here, packed their dog up and went home. So he stood around watching, and the family members did, and said, okay, now can you use your dog? He said, I can, the police are gone now. And he found them straight away within 10 minutes. He found in the exact location that the police dog had been searching. And you see, there's, again, too much of a them and us. We should be all training together. We should be getting together at least 2 to 3 times a year. We can train individually, but the standard should be the same. There should be a set standard, period. But unfortunately, if that happens, the people who will be asked to set the standard will be the wrong people, because they'll be people who are probably government-sponsored agencies. The people who should be asked about these things won't be asked. And then you'll get standards drawn up that will suit a particular team, because the people who draw it up will be have brothers or sisters, or they may be a member of that team, so it'll suit that team. There should be international standards, no question about it. When a person is reported missing here, the first thing the guards do, not their fault, because this is the system, is they make a note of it. And that's it. Nothing happens. Unless the family go to the press. If there's a furore created by the family, then something will happen. But superintendents in various divisions, when it comes to their attention, then the first thing the superintendent will ask is, okay, how much is in the budget? Can we afford the helicopter? Can we afford the Garda divers? Can we afford the Navy divers? Because all these are charged to the local division. And if there's not enough in the budget, then it won't be called in. If there's not a furore kicked up about it, nothing will be done unless the family do something. Again, it's not the guards' fault. The guards are doing what they can within the limitations of their rules and regulations and their budget again. One of the many things we are asked by Garda when we're called in is, how much do you charge? And when they hear we don't charge anything, oh, come on down, so straight away. They don't ask us if we're qualified. They don't ask us really who we are. Oh, just come down. For instance, when I was in the international team, British International Response Team, they would fly a helicopter to Cork Airport, pick me up and take me over for training, no question, and looked after you like a king. But to get out of Ireland, within the 26 counties, everything was... You looked after yourself. But outside of that, I have to say, and I don't care what people say about Britain, as far as I was concerned, they couldn't look after us well enough. They were the best people you could possibly imagine, including the north of Ireland. It's just the 26 counties was the problem, because we're trapped in this cocoon of attitude, this small-minded attitude. Even when two of us went to America last year, people were saying, who do you think you are going off to America and all this kind of thing. And then even when the American police officers came over here, there were still people saying that there are no cadaver dogs in Ireland. Cadaver training is a scientific process. We were certified by the American police. We did, even though we had cadaver dogs before that, which proved our training was correct anyway. We're going back there next May we're going to Holland in 4 weeks time, training for 10 days. And this is all out of our own pockets. What do we need to do to prove our dogs are capable? We've gone as, you know, if somebody goes missing, we don't want to get called out because I have to close my shop or the lads have to leave their workplace. So it's a nuisance. But we do it because we love training dogs primarily, and we love training dogs. We love seeing our dogs doing what they were trained to do, which is hunting people as opposed to hunting animals. And the fact that it's a benefit to the community is a big bonus to us then. And like, again, it goes back to missing people. When you meet their families, you understand why you do it. You know, it's you see the loss in their face and the helplessness, you'll do it. There's no question you'll do it, you know.
Mick McCarthy on the training and working with water rescue dogs. There will be a talk by Edward J. Burke, maritime historian and author of Bound for Australia on the loss of the Tailleur at the Strandbar in Rush on Thursday, the 23rd of January, being close to the 160th anniversary of the disaster, which falls on Monday. The Rush and Lochshinney Historical Society will host two talks that night, starting at 8 o'clock. The first will be a filmed recording of an interview with Moss Weldon, followed by an anniversary talk on the Tailleur. More detail on the Maritime website, www.lugnad.ie. And that's next Thursday in the Strand Bar in Rush. Next week here on Seascapes, maritime archaeologist Michael Gibbons will be talking to us about how medieval burial sites, a Neolithic bog, and prehistoric remains on Omi Island have been among the discoveries following the recent storms. Irish oysters are under threat from an invasive Pacific species. We'll be hearing from Padraig Fogarty of the Irish Wildlife Trust. We'll have the latest on the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race, and much more. Until next Friday night, tight lines, fair sailing.